The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the interview.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But Ducrell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 129.
A delightful dystopian narrative discussion with James Decker and Andrew Liptak.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And our special guests, if it's not already obvious, are James Decker.
Hello.
And Andrew Liptak.
Hello.
So our discussion will be a little free range because we have a lot of random stuff to talk about. But first, we should probably talk about the big topic, which is why are dystopian narratives so prevalent throughout science fiction history? And I'm going to define science fiction history since roughly the turn of the century, even though technically science fiction precedes it. I take the track that science fiction as a genre isn't codified until roughly the pulp era. But Andrew may take umbrage.
No, I don't think so. I think that's a pretty good time to define it. And that's when you had the Hugo Gernsback actually name it science fiction or yeah. Scientific fiction.
Yeah, the very difficult to say word. So all right, so who's got a theory? Why are dystopian narratives so prevalent?
I have a theory.
Uh-oh.
The reason why dystopian narratives are present in science fiction so commonly is because dystopian narratives are present in our culture from thousands of years ago. We are a culture that sometimes lives from catastrophe to catastrophe, be it in art or science or popular literature or science fiction. Dystopia or things going far wrong and having to survive the consequences afterwards is something that's we're used to as a species. I mean, think of the fall of the Roman Empire and the remnants of Europe afterwards is a dystopia. I mean, the Dark Ages is a dystopia to anybody living, comparing it to 200 years previous. So why should science fiction be any different? There's an allure and a desire to at least look at what would life be like if the slate got wiped clean or the big strike just reset everything and you'd have to scramble from the top and everything is all the cards have fallen down and you have to pick them up again. There's just something about that humans resonate with, and it's possible you can even go all the way back to when nearly humanity got wiped out 80,000 years ago. Maybe that's where we all get it from that catastrophe that nearly wiped out humanity, though.
Are you suggesting we have a gene that is like the dystopia gene?
It's part of the collective unconscious.
I think it's part of the collective unconscious that we're always ready for disaster. I mean, the Ice Ages were a disaster. I mean, it just seems like that there's not very long periods of stability for us to get used to stability. And disaster is always lurking around the corner, and dystopias are a way of looking forward to the next disaster, even if the disaster that comes isn't the one we imagine.
Hmm.
I mean, I think part of it too is, I mean, you know, that just from a structural point of view, I mean, when you're writing about the future, I mean, it's, you know, you don't necessarily want to write about a time when everything is going right. You know, I mean, if everything is fine, then it's a little harder to, you know, dredge up, you know, a reason for heroes to exist, you know?
I don't know if I agree with that it's an inherent cultural or human thing. The way I've seen a lot of these things is science fiction is a very political genre, and it tends to reflect the politics and the attitudes of the day. Human memory doesn't really go back any more than 50 years to a century. And I think that you see a lot of dystopian literature coming out around the time when you have a large large democracy movements moving around and gaining power throughout human history, you know, a couple hundred years ago. Some of the more prevalent dystopian stories out there, I just read We, and I can't remember the Russian author's name.
Yevgeny Zamyatin.
Yeah, that's that one.
I'm probably saying his name wrong, but...
Well, you're saying it better than I can, but he wrote his novel at the time when Russia had a lot of turmoil. George Orwell wrote his novel when there was a lot of, societal turmoil. So you see a lot of these sort of dystopian novels being written at times when there's a lot of political uncertainty and people worrying that government is becoming too powerful for its own good. And you sort of have this bridge of, personal liberty versus the bureaucracy of an overwhelming government. And I think that's one reason why it's very popular in American circles and probably why we're seeing a lot of people running around screaming today. But a lot of the lessons that we can learn out of dystopian fiction tend to go back about 50 to 100 years.
Yeah, and I think I kind of a little bit agree with both. And that might be because I'm actually teaching a dystopia class right now. And so, like, one of the books that we're reading right now is Jack London's The Iron Heel, which most people aren't familiar with. And that's actually very much a response to what was going on right prior to the First World War and what would be the Great Depression. And it's really eerie when you read this book because you start to notice things that he's essentially predicting, even though he's not really trying to predict because that's not what genre fiction is about. But he's essentially predicting the Great Depression and like an amalgamation of the First and Second Wars. It's really weird because the German Emperor is still around, but yet Japan has now become this colonial empire and they're both all in war and it's disaster zone. So like on the one hand, I think that Andrew, you're right, that dystopia is very much in response to the political arena, as it were, particularly when it comes to books like The Iron Heel or even something like Kim Stanley Robinson's California. I believe the Gold Coast is the hyper-capitalist dystopia. These kinds of books have a tendency to kind of deal with the real-world politics, but then we end up with somewhat different stuff that maybe are dealing with some real-world politics, but not in the explicit sense. Like, I think... Make Room, Make Room by Harry Harrison, or even something like Logan's Run. They're both dystopian texts, but they deal with it. They're dealing with politics that are maybe not the same kind of overarching, huge terror that something like, say, the what becomes the Red Scare roughly like the 30s to the after the World War II period.
Make Room was a response to a lot of population boom.
Yeah,
and for some people, that's a really scary thing. And I remember watching Soylent Green, and there was some pretty eerie moments there. So when I say science fiction is about politics, it doesn't have to follow it the modern day exactly. Otherwise, all you have to do is flip on CNN. But you take the politics of the day and you twist it a little bit so that it's just recognizable for the message you're trying to get across.
Yeah, I mean that's. I mean, I think I understand your point a little bit more clearly. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't have anything intelligent to add to that. Sorry.
Well, Andrew does have a point. Thinking that of some of the dystopias more recently are all environmental, from Tobias Bukel's Arctic Rising to Shipbreaker to a bunch of the world's climate gets wrecked and. Now we have to live in the pieces of it. There's an enormous amount of short fiction and YA fiction that's dealing with those ideas.
Yeah, Paolo Bacigalupi's short fiction and his novels. Yeah. I mean, even the Wind-Up Girl deals with certain issues to do with the environment.
Let's something that might benefit us is to actually define what a dystopia is, because a dystopia is not just a place where it's unpleasant for people to live. There's a very political aspect to it when it comes to science fiction, just as there's a very political aspect to post-apocalyptic fiction. A really good sort of benchmark that I've been working off of is John Joseph Adams' two anthologies. Actually, now it's four anthologies. You've got Brave New Worlds, which has the dystopian side, and then you have the Wastelands and Wastelands 2, which is about to come out, which has the post-apocalyptic side. One is very, very, as I'd characterize it, as very left-wing. We have oppressive governments ruling over its people, and then a very right-wing anarchist sort of storylines where there's no government control and people are left to their own devices, which in itself leads to some very interesting philosophical discussions as to, you know, what is the nature of human nature pushing more towards one or the other? And I suspect that it probably depends on whichever country you're coming from.
Yeah. Well, so my benchmark the definition I use that I find the most useful, because it does get, when you look into the critical scholarship, the definitions of dystopia become really terrifying, because they're just really complicated. But the one I tend to use is, it's a world that is has some sort of critical change in its makeup, whether it's a social change, a political change, a environmental change can also be a possibility, that has led to a world that is radically worse than the author's present.
Well, that also defines post-apocalyptic fiction.
It certainly would include certain kinds of post-apocalyptic fiction. I would take out a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction that, so like natural disasters, I don't consider those to be dystopias. They have dystopian elements. I mean, that's sure, because there's weird stuff that happens after disasters. But things like where nuclear war has occurred, and then you have, like, I'm thinking, I Have No Mouth, But I Must Scream, I think that's the correct title, by Harlan Ellison, or there's other books in which there's a nuclear war or some crazy shit has happened, and then you have some society that's sprung up to survive the disaster, or even like Logan's Ride is a great example. Something has happened to the world, it's gone to pot, and here's this dome city, but that dome city itself is a dystopia. It appears to be a utopia, but it's masking itself. So
the big overarching point to this, I think, is that there's some sort of intent behind it, behind any sort of governmental structure where you have such a dome in Logan's Run or the wastelands of Mad Max. So you can sort of have both. You can have both environments in the same place. You can have a utopian society existing in the aftermath of a post-apocalyptic world. Does that make sense?
Sure. Or, well, one that appears to be, because it's not in Logan's Run, but it appears to be.
Well, that's right, sort of like, the thing, is that most dystopians, I mean, the word dystopia comes from, you know, anti-utopia. And it seems like every time anybody tries to make a better world, and there's a great quote out of Serenity, where the government in the verse tries to make people better, it just ends up backfiring, and it doesn't make things better. So there's that intent behind it. I think that is the crucial point.
James, you had something to say?
Yeah, no, I mean, I was just going to basically agree with that. I mean, it's I wouldn't consider like things like Mad Max or, you know, Shipbreaker to necessarily be dystopias. I think more of like 1984 or Serenity, like you just said, even like the Hunger Games. I mean, any situation where you have a society that its rulers and maybe even some of its populace would consider perfect, when viewed through our lens, it's actually like horrible.
I think that's a great point, James. And I was thinking of that as you were saying it, that in many cases a dystopia is ostensibly an utopia, at least advertised to its citizens and its populace. The setup in 1984, it's supposedly Big Brother is protecting you and watching over you. Whereas when we look at it, it's like, oh my god, it's a hellhole, it's a nightmare.
So I think it was William. I want to say William Gibson, and apologies to Mr. Gibson if I'm misquoting him here, but like I believe he said something to the effect of like people were talking about Neuromancer, I think, and referring to the sprawl as a dystopia, and he said something to the effect of anybody who thought that had never been to a large city, you know, like the bad part of a large city, that, I mean, this is something that exists all over the place in a world that's not by definition a dystopia. It's just a bad area.
Yeah, I mean, well, and that's part of what leads to the kind of utopian tradition, was an attempt to imagine better places than the whatever the present happens to be for the. And so you get all the utopian communities in like the 1800s in particular, all these places springing up trying to create these perfect worlds, and then they all fall apart and collapse. Usually,
I've visited one of those.
You've been to one?
I have, near my wife's family's home in Pennsylvania. There's a settlement that's been protected. I think it's the Euphrates, not Euphrates, something cloister in Pennsylvania. It's really interesting. And it was a complete failure.
But the community is like, do people live there? Or is it like one of those historic sites?
No, it's a preserved historical site. It existed for a while, and at its height, it had a couple hundred people living on in its dormitories, and they'd basically get up at absurd hours of the morning, pray, eat very little, go out and work for 6 hours, pray, eat very little, and I think they were described as these people who were. Like if you were to go up and walk up to them, they wouldn't be quite all there because they were sleep deprived and starving. But they were also believed that the return of Jesus would be imminent, and so they didn't really care.
Oh yeah. What's really interesting about the utopian communities is they tend to fall into two categories, and there are exceptions, but they usually fall into two categories. There's some version of what would become a socialist utopian community. Depending on different definitions or how people wanted to interpret it. And then the religious utopian communities, which like the one you're describing, Andrew, they're actually really fascinating. The kind almost like cultish behavior you see with these utopian communities, but you're right. Most of them fail, for various reasons. Usually it's financial or something bad happens.
And this one was their downfall came when their leader died. It's called the Euphrata Cloister in Pennsylvania, if anybody wants to Google it. And it's a really neat place. And they had some pictures of what it looked like when it was sort of in its heyday, and the buildings are preserved. But like, these are people who would sleep on wooden pillows because they didn't want to have too restful of a sleep, because they might miss the saving events. But yeah, they're definitely out there.
It's a bit extreme.
Very, yeah, and that's what these people were. They were religious extremists. They weren't the violent religious extremists, but they were still very extreme. And apparently they had some tensions with the locals, but they were happy to trade for food and whatnot.
Huh. Well, there you go. So we kind of bring in all of that up because it is important for the kind of the history of dystopian literature, because as you were saying earlier, Andrew, that a lot of dystopian literature, or at least dystopia itself, comes from the idea of being anti-utopian. And that's actually true. A lot of the literature that's written that we consider dystopian was written in response to various utopian ideals, whether they were things that led to those communities or they were trains of thought or ideologies which were perceived to be utopian, et cetera. Or there's even this really this hilarious like racist diatribe called the A Sojourn in the City of Amalgamation, which I recommend people Google it just so you can read it and you can giggle at how terrified white people were in 1835. Because it's set during when particularly England and various parts of Europe were either about to or had already abolished slavery, or at least various things associated with it. And it's all of it is just a story about how if you get rid of slavery in America, we're going to end up in this weird, terrifying dystopia in which white people and black people are freely intermingling and that they get married together, and that in order to get over being racist because he perceives it to be a natural phenomenon, you have to go through this process called boiling, in which a giant monster creature puts you in a vat and sprays weird oils on you and like mixes you around. And then you have little machines that follow you around and spray perfume so you don't smell black people. Because apparently, apparently racism has a stench. I didn't realize this, but it's this fascinating, just this, it's a dystopia from his perspective. It seems like a dystopia. But then when you think about it, even from our perspective, it's like, if we take any of this as gospel, that seems like a dystopia to us as well. This idea that you have to go and have a monster put you in a vat.
mix you
to get rid of your racist feelings is kind of terrifying. But all of these kind of leading us backwards in time, because I think we were considering only talking about the kind of last 100 years. But I don't really know where any of that was going. But it's interesting factoids, so go look it up.
Put a pin in that.
Yeah, well, I think so. So there have been talks before about dystopias in relation to there being almost like cycles. Even during the last the economic downturn, there were people trying to figure out like whether or not dystopias actually rise during times of economic strife. And I can't remember what the conclusions were, or if there were no conclusions whatsoever. Does anyone remember?
I think it's not a matter of, I think Andrew had it right. It's not a matter of economics, a matter of political, social strife and change and agitation that these sorts of narratives come forward. And I think there's always dystopias being printed, but they do seem to have their peaks and the troughs, and we're going up a peak now again. But these are not so much political, but I wonder if the political instability, for lack of a better word, in the United States is causing them to become manifest, even if the actual, most of them aren't really political in nature. Well, at least not in the sense of 1984 or...
Right, a directly political approach. Right. Yeah. Something like the Hunger Games, as far as I know, is not purposely directly responding to any particular current politics that I'm aware of anyway. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there is, but... And yet,
well, the author wrote the books after watching the Iraq War and then flipping between channels to see reality TV. So there's certainly a social element to it. I don't know if there's any explicit political thing to it, but I mean, there's sort of politics weaved in there in the background.
Well, it's certainly not an unusual idea. I mean, that's existed, the idea of various kinds of brutish contests as entertainment for some sort of elite class. I mean, even like what was the Death Race? Was that the name of that? The original Death with the car, and he goes into the
Day
prison.
First 2000.
Yeah, there you go. That's the basic idea. Or even we've seen recently there was the that movie with Gerard Butler where he's
Lockout.
No, not Lockout. No.
Gamer?
Gamer, yeah. There's another example, right, where people, if you go to prison, your body gets used in a video game, essentially. So, yeah. But anyway, I'm sorry, James. You wanted to add?
They compare the Hunger Games to Battle Royale a lot, but I think that's a little bit unfair, just because, you know, as you kind of pointed out, the whole Bloodsport thing has been around for a long time.
Yeah, and Battle Royale is, I want to say, although I don't know enough about it, that has that actually direct political element to it.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, probably something to do with the intersections or the interrelationship between the older parts of that, of Japanese society and the younger parts, but I don't know enough about it to actually make a comment. So if anyone here does, great, go for it.
No, unfortunately not.
Yeah, I mean, I can't. I mean, I've read it, but I can't pretend to know enough about their.
Oh, well, okay. Well, if anybody else knows who is listening, please leave a comment or something and just let us know. So, Andrew, did you want to jump in?
No, I think you handled it okay.
Awesome. I'm smart.
Okay. One thing about dystopia that I've been thinking of recently is that it's not something that's related just to the United States. It's very prevalent in the United States, and there's a lot of works that have come from us, but there's a couple of interesting ones that have come out from other countries. One was the one I mentioned earlier, We, and then there's another one that just came out in China called The Fat Years, and I don't know what the Chinese name is, and I don't know the author.
I heard about that one too, yeah.
And so something that's sort of interesting is that I tend to listen to the news a lot, especially out of things from the Middle East, and from my listening, dystopians are alive and well in the world. Go read a book, a graphic novel called Persepolis, and there's a really good example of what could, you read some of this stuff and you think that it's science fiction, and then you sort of look at this one particular comic. It's very much a real story. But also, a lot of these countries in the Middle East and Africa that are currently undergoing a lot of stress and with extremism versus their governments, there's a good point to be made, or at least very good material to be mined from it, for somebody who's creative and enterprising and wants to see what one really looks like.
Yeah, and that's actually a really, really interesting point. I mean, there was a graphic novel called Walk with Bashir, and I've forgotten the name, and it was made into a movie, or it was a movie and it was made into a graphic novel. I can't remember which. One or the other. And it's more or less based on real experiences during, I think, the Israeli-Lebanon conflicts. I may be mistaking, so I apologize. So if somebody wants to correct me, please do. And it's very much, I've not seen Persepolis, I haven't seen that, but I imagine there are similar themes in terms of the kinds of things going on, and that's a great example, I think, of a story that has those kinds of dark dystopian elements. And once you realize that, what seems like a dystopia to us is actually sometimes happening in the real world, is actually, I think, slightly more terrifying than going and watching Logan's Run and finding that world disturbing. But yeah, I mean, looking at the one of the problems, and I guess that, Andrew, you kind of essentially brought this up, is outside of the United Kingdom and America and other English-speaking countries, and maybe France and Russia, not a lot of stuff gets translated from those other countries. So there could be a plethora of really great dystopias in, like an Egyptian dystopian novel that we don't even know about because we can't read it because we're not Egyptian. Or it's being written right now based on and that would be really fascinating to see what would they consider to be the dystopia as a result of the still tumultuous sort of conditions in Egypt right now.
It would probably be fairly different from what we would take given the religious elements to it. Persepolis, if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. That has to do with the rise of the Ayatollah in Iran, and the Iraq-Iran war. But if you want to read some foreign dystopian picture, The Fat Years, I just looked it up. It's Chan Kun Chung. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. That was just translated by David C. Into English, so that's now available in the United States.
Excellent.
Yeah, no, that's good. I think I heard about it, and I definitely want to watch it read it. Some sort of animal is going crazy over there.
That is my cat attacking my shoe. I'm sorry. I thought I had muted myself.
That's a cat? I thought it was a giant dog.
That's what I thought, too.
That is Merlin. Merlin the magician, and he's very ferocious right now. Hang on a second.
Sure. Well, why don't we kind of just switch gears then, and just let other people who would like to jump in.
James, who's been quiet.
Or James, yeah. James, do you have anything you want to add, or do you want to switch topics?
I think we've covered it.
Okay, so if anybody out there wants to add, go ahead and do it. There'll be info in the end. So really quick, I just want to talk about the aliens one because we don't have time to talk about all the other stuff. So what I'm curious is, after looking at this list of 25 greatest aliens of all time that were voted for by people who read thegeektwins.com. What exactly is missing?
Oh, where to begin?
Xenomorph.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Sorry, I had to interrupt. I couldn't keep it in.
Where is the xenomorph?
Does this, I mean, do they explicitly say it can only be from movies?
No, no, there's Doctor Who appears on it, Spock from Star Trek.
I mean, well, movies are indoor television.
It seems like it's anything.
Well, every one of their choices is movies or television. There's nothing that's strictly a novel. Oh, I mean, you won't find the Miri from C.G. Cherry's novels in here, for example. Although I would put them on the list, as well as any of the alien races in the Channer series should be on here. I mean the Kif. Where are the Kif on this list?
Is it one of the greatest the cat ones, right?
No, those are the reptilian lizard ones that would be most happy to eat you.
Yeah, I mean, to be totally honest, I think their audience is primarily film based. So yeah, because everything on here is from film. I don't think, even their honorable mentions include only film based stuff. But it seems really odd of a list. Like, I mean, for example, one of the people that appears on here is T'Pol from Star Trek Enterprise, which I guess is a rather contemporary example, but would not be on my top 25 list of greatest aliens of all time.
Yeah, she's all right.
I mean, well, she's not. It's not even that she's all right. She's just basically the same guy from Voyager, just a woman.
Tuvok.
Tuvok. It's just Tuvok, but a girl. I'm not being like trying to be mean, but her character is, and this is my problem with a lot of the Star Trek universe, is basically all the Star Treks are just recreations. I mean, Star Trek Enterprise was a really nice switch because you had the psychic lady, which was fun. But I mean, you get these kind of repetitions. Like the latest repetition is now we're going to have basically the same Vulcan character every single episode, but they're not really characters. They're just super duper logicals. Right. Yeah. Just archetypes, you know, or like, I mean, the aliens of Stargate SG, or excuse me, of 2001 Space Odyssey, they're not even in the movie, really.
Yeah, that was a very bad choice because we never see them. We just see what they do.
We don't even see what they do. We just know that they leave weird monuments everywhere, and somehow that influences or is involved in different stages of human evolution.
But well, I don't think we even get a view into it until the 2010 one, right?
Okay, well, yeah, and most people haven't seen that. So.
It's underrated. I liked it. I thought it was an enjoyable flick. It wasn't as good as the first one, but
I think that was inevitable.
Yeah. But the Aliens of 2001, I'll actually defend being on there because they're sort of one of those. It's a very neat archetype, sort of alien, the ultimate creator. Unfortunately, they also put on the engineers from Prometheus, which was a little underwhelming, I thought.
Yeah, we talked about that before you were able to get on, and I think the only reason people picked it is because they just seem kind of cool and they're psychotic and evil. But
I don't even know if they're psychotic or evil. You just see them. You know, I don't even know what they're doing in that movie.
Well, yeah, I mean that's the problem with them, is we don't even really know what their motivations are.
Yeah. Of course, the same can be said for the 2001 guys. But
that's true. But they didn't show up on screen and do the weirdness. Whatever.
Spend the last part of the movie just rampaging for no clear reason.
Right. I mean, I don't know. And then, of course, trying to destroy the Earth, which was why? But whatever. Like they put on Dathon from Star Trek The Next Generation. I don't even remember that person.
He was in one episode.
Is that the one where they could only speak through like analogy or something like that?
That's the one.
Yeah. That's actually a good episode.
It's a good episode, but we only see it race once, and that's it.
Yeah. Does he deserve to be on the list of a lifetime? I don't know.
Yeah, like of all time. I don't know.
I don't even think a species ever shows up again.
Not that I've ever seen.
No, although they went to, when you look at the picture, I mean, they went to a lot of lengths to try to make them as original as they could make bipedal humanoid species, but there's lots of orifices, which I guess I could appreciate that, because it's weird. I guess, I mean, like, who would we include? I mean, we've mentioned already, you know, like, the xenomorph from the Alien series. What else?
The aliens from China Mavale's Embassy Town.
Yeah, if we went to literature, like, they would be really fascinating. Yeah. Or,
Babylon,
like,
5, you've got a whole plethora of types there that aren't even mentioned. They mentioned them in the honorable mentions, but...
Yeah, the Lando Malari, yeah.
He's not the most interesting. Yeah. There's other guys that are more interesting than he is.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
It's a dumb list.
I'm surprised that they included, I mean, from Stargate, they include Apophis, but not Ra.
Well, Ra was in the movie and he got killed, or Teok. I mean, we have a whole interesting race that he's part of with interesting, unique culture that has interesting intersections with the Tari. I would have put him on there before Apophis.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I would even put Ra in there. Maybe just because I'm rather fond of the movie because it's got Kurt Russell in it. But I thought Ra was so evil, and because he was rather the physical form he takes is this young person, and yet this voice of hell comes out of his mouth.
Yeah, he was creepy.
He was just uber creepy, and also kind of like in an evil way, just a badass because
using kids as human shields. Yeah, he was.
Yeah. Oh yeah, or even what was I thinking? Like they just inserted some like random stuff, but like if you're gonna go for a Star Trek character, one that's I think rather interesting is Deep Space Nine's Dax. It just because is everyone familiar with Dax from Deep Space Nine?
Right, both Daxes. So, right, the symbiotic.
Right, they're humanoids. I don't know what the species is originally, some sort of species, but they're essentially the humanoid. Body is not the actual being, it's the symbiotic like worm gizmo that goes inside of them, but they live multiple lives and have entirely separate lives in different bodies.
Yeah,
and yet they're part of the same lineage. It's a very really interesting, and it's a character that's well developed because it's the character exists throughout the Deep Space Nine series. So
even the shapeshifter guy was more interesting than some of the entries on this list.
Yeah, Odo?
Yeah,
Odo.
Because nobody knows who he is, and that's one of the interesting questions that they ask is, who is he? Where does he come from?
Supposedly, he doesn't even know. Yeah, right. He finds out.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Or, I mean, going back to literature, we could go with, I mean, it's kind of unfair to the list to kind of go to literature, because I'm guessing they really meant film, but, I mean, you could go to something like Tobias Bekele's the satraps, which are these almost like giant horseshoe crab like monstrosities that have managed to control every other sentient species in their sector in one way or another, and they're just incredibly powerful beings. I mean, there's just so much. So it was a very strange list, I thought.
Farscape.
Yeah, I was just gonna mention that a lot of good creations from Farscape.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that too, yeah.
Yeah, Moya. Why isn't Moya on this list? A living ship, kids.
I know, that is kind of cool, right?
Yeah. This is one of the things with a list, though, is that every list is always wrong. No matter what you put on it, you're always going to have people who are like, wait, what about this? What about that? So, I mean, it's a neat list, but there's definitely a lot of things that are...
The fact that they included Marty the Martian on it, like, I mean, I think they meant it to be
kind of fun,
lighthearted.
Yeah.
Although, to be fair, I might include Marty the Martian in a list. If only because, I mean, you know, we could go with only serious examples, but, you know, a little bit of humor is fun.
They have Jake from Cat from Outer Space on there. That automatically makes it a win. I loved that film as a kid.
All right, so just a kind of closing out, but actually, before we do that, just really quick to get James to talk about something that's really important, which is he has a book.
Right.
That whole book thing that you're supposedly advertising for.
Did that come out today?
It's called The Burn Zone. Did it come out today?
Yep.
Day of the recording?
Happy release day.
Well, that's awesome.
Day of the recording.
So tell us a little bit about The Burn Zone.
All right, I'll give you like the kind of elevator pitch version. It takes place in an alternate future kind of version of Earth in a fictional city called Hangfei, where this alien race called the Han have been stranded. Now, over the course of like, say, the 50 years that have passed prior to the opening of the Burn Zone, they've become integrated in the society to the point where their young are actually raised by human surrogates. Who bond with them through these implanted sort of mental receivers, which allow them to share thoughts with the Han. Sam Shao, she's the story's protagonist. She's one of those surrogates, and she's actually caring for a Han infant when her adopted father, who's a member of the military, returns home like early from his tour. And he's being chased by his former comrades. When they storm into the apartment, she picks up a new signal through those surrogate receivers and realizes that they're actually being led by a Han in disguise. They take her father from her, and she's sort of left to figure out the mystery of what it was that he uncovered during his tour that made them come after him, and to try to track him down and get him back. And along the way, of course, she ends up finding out that the story of the Han and the deals they've made with the government go a lot deeper than anyone thought.
That's actually really interesting. So it starts a little bit like Alien Nation, but then quickly becomes a kind of this like conspiracy kind of narrative, essentially.
Yeah, they live in, kind of flipping back to the dystopia or post-apocalyptic or whatever. I mean, they're living in a world that's kind of it's most of the other countries in this world are starting to buckle under lack of resources, overpopulation, and stuff like that. The existence of the Han in this one country is actually, and their sharing of their like highly advanced technology is part of what's kind of keeping them from going under as well. So there's this kind of like, they're kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, you're not quite sure what exactly they're up to, not quite certain whether or not the government understands the depth of the deals they're making with them. That's kind of part of picking that apart is, one of the overarching things of the series. So
it's actually perfect that we talked about aliens and dystopias for this episode.
Right. Yep.
So by the time this episode goes live, it will be on bookshelves. It's in mass market paperback, which means it's $7.99, which means nobody has an excuse not to buy it now.
It's also on Kindle, I see.
Yep.
Yeah. So everybody should go check it out.
And it's got a cool cover.
Say what?
Got a cool cover, too.
Yeah, I got a cool cover. I got very lucky with that. If I could just shout out one quick thing, too. There's also a prequel novella to it called Ember, which is also available in ebook format only.
Okay, and I'm guessing people can find that on Amazon or wherever they get their ebooks from?
Yep, it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, Sony, and I imagine Apple.
But who knows with them?
I couldn't find where they kept them.
That actually sometimes happens with Barnes & Noble, which is one of its problems. So everyone should go definitely check this out. It does have a cool cover. I really appreciate that the woman on the front cover is not bending at an awkward angle. So...
Jim Himes won't have to try to replicate this cover out.
Right, because it's a rather natural pose.
it's actually kind of funny because like that was kind of one of the stipulations. They ask you for input, for the cover, and how much of your input they choose to take and how much they ignore is not something you get a lot of control over. But I had sort of, pushed for, I didn't want her to be hypersexualized. I wanted her to be, she's supposed to come from a world where, people are living on rations and they're mostly starving, So try to reflect she's a normal, partially starved person and not a Playboy pinup.
Yes.
So I think they did a pretty good job. You did a pretty good job. That's Dave Seeley that did the artwork for that.
Yeah, it's a very nice cover. And, of course, you do have some rather important blurbs from Robert J. Sawyer and Mira Grant. Which,
yeah, I got lucky there, too.
Yeah, I don't know how you managed that. You must have called it. You must have, like, put in a couple favors, you know?
I think my editor did.
Cool. So, all right. So everybody go check out the Burn Zone, and they can find you, James, at jameskdecker.com. So yep. Make sure to put the K in there. And they can also find you, your other work at, do you have another website for your other work?
Oh yeah. James K. Decker is kind of an open pseudonym. I have an original series called the Reviver series, which includes State of Decay, The Silent Army, and Element Zero, which were written under the name James Knapp. And you can find information about them at www.james-knapp.com.
Perfect. All right, guys. So that about does it for the show. So, Andrew, really quick before you disappear, where can people find you? You got anything in the works that they should know about?
You can find me at andrewliptak.com or at andrewliptak on Twitter. My current big project is a science fiction history column on Kirkus Reviews, which you can find links through my website.
Or whenever I retweet the link to it.
Or whenever Paul retweets the link. Although you haven't been commenting lately, so.
My bad.
We need to get you to do that so we can get some discussion going.
Yeah, you suck, Paul. Come on.
No, he always asks good questions, so.
Cool. Well, everybody should go check out Andrew's website, his columns, and do leave comments, actually. That would be a really cool idea, too. So
I'm going to leave a plug for the latest column. It's on C.L. Moore, who is an early female writer in the genre, which I'm very eager to see hit the public, especially because when doing some research, I found three previously unknown stories from her. So there'll be links.
Oh, that's cool. Well, there you go.
There's much squeeing.
Cool. Well, thank you, James and Andrew, for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You gonna say thank you, Andrew?
Thank you. Sorry, I hit mute. I don't think.
Ungrateful bastard. No, just cool. And we will see everybody with the episode that comes after. So, take care. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.